Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, and today we have a real treat. We have Andrew Shelley, who in some capacity has been involved with the world of squash for nearly 50 years. Andrew, he says he's an administrator, but I call him the author of this beautiful, beautiful book. It's like a, what do you call it? A coffee table book all about squash. Then and Now, a Celebration. And really, it's just beautiful. I would show you the pages, but I'm not that. Let's see. I mean, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book with the history of squash. So much, so much, so much. So thank you, Andrew, for doing that. And welcome to the studio. Hello.
Well, good morning from London. Good old.
Yes. Now, before we start, I would like to dedicate this show to my, I played varsity squash at the University of Pennsylvania, and we won't say when, but a long time ago, and I was the captain, and my coach passed away. Let's see if I can show her obituary. Here it is. So my coach was Ann Dietrich Wetzel, who passed away in May of 2024. We called her Coach. That's what we called her. And she was quite the character. And she taught me how to play. She guided us. She was our leader. And we probably gave her more trouble than she deserved. But this show, Anne, is dedicated to you. And thank you for everything you did for us. She was really a unique and wonderful individual. Let's see if I can show this other screen. Let's just see how good I am at this.
Sounds as if she was a very special lady.
Yes. And here, if you can see this, that's her playing squash. She was a champion. I mean, you know, back before people did this, and this talks about Penn Athletics, you know, mourning her. Anyway, you can read that. You could find it at Penn Athletics or her obituary if you want more information. I can put this in the show notes as well. So let me come back to Andrew here. But anyway, so thank you, Anne, for all you've done. Thank you to her children. And anyway, that's it. This is for her. She was, I don't know, I didn't do the math. 1931 to 24, 93. And yeah, amazing. All right, now that I'm crying. So welcome, Andrew. And so I met Andrew through one of my other guests, Thomas Tarantino, who was also involved with the world of squash. If you love squash, you can also go to that interview. He did a whole bunch of stuff, right? I mean, just traveled the world for women's squash and started tournaments all over, right? Crazy place.
Has been a great supporter of squash.
Yeah.
And the library and previously, but we can come to that.
Yeah, we'll get there. Okay. All right. So Andrew, so you have spent nearly 50 years in the world of squash. How did you, well, I'm assuming you were born in England. Do we call it England? That was one question I have. I've never asked anyone. When do we say England? When do we say the UK?
Well, England is part of the UK, but we can just call it God's country. That's enough. We don't need to go beyond that. No, you have England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. That becomes the UK.
Okay, so if I'm just talking about England, I say England. Okay, if I'm talking about the whole thing. Okay, cool. All right, that's good. Never knew that. Okay, so you were born in England/God's country, right? What? Where were you born?
Well, I'm a Londoner, and you can probably hear from my accent, I'm called a Cockney, which means I was born within the sound of Bow Bells in North East London. But I'm a Londoner through and through. It's all,
oh, wow.
I've never moved out. But,
wow.
It's
and Cockney, I always think, means like struggling, like not the upper class. I have no idea if I'm right, but is that correct?
Well, in terms of background, yes. But the point about Cockneys is that they, in going back centuries, they had their own language to prevent other people listening to them, and it's called Cockney rhyming slang.
Oh.
If you, for example, were going up the apples, you'd be going up the apples and pears stairs. It's that sort of. There was a singer called Ruby Murray. So if you have a ruby, a Cockney would know you mean a Ruby Murray curry. It's that sort of, it's defunct now. But there's so many words from the Cockney rhyming slang that are in the English language that people don't even know why. You can hear people calling this your barnet. What they don't realise is it was barnet fair hair. And so it goes on. But it's from centuries ago. But I'm.
So did you learn it?
I'm a Londoner.
So did you learn it?
No. You don't learn it. It's just part of life.
So did you have that, and then regular speaking when you were like not there or no?
Oh no, you don't realize you're doing it. It's just if you're from an area where other people talk. So I would say to people, can I have a butcher's at that? Which means butcher's hook, look. But we just call it a butcher's. And we don't relate it to Cockney rhyming slang. It's just how we speak.
What does it mean?
Butcher's hook, look. Can I have a look? It's all linked rhyming.
So what you really wanted to say was, could I have a look? No. But they had put in the butcher's hook look.
No.
Four, or is it not that?
Exactly. There's thousands of words. And as I say, most people don't even realize they're speaking Cockney because it's part of the English language.
Wow.
What's
one more example?
I can't actually think. While we're talking, I'll probably realize I'm saying something.
Well, the bonnet one. What was the bonnet?
Barnet fair hair. Because there was a fairground, as it were, at Barnet, which is actually not very far from where I'm sitting. Barnet fair hair, apples and pears stairs, that sort of thing.
I see. So they would put it before the word.
No, they would say barnet, so that centuries ago people didn't realize it was
hair.
Talking about your hair. And obviously, there will have been military and other secrets that were being passed through code.
Interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. But everybody talked that way, right? If you went to high society or whatever, would they talk the same or no?
Probably not, no. Okay. But as I say, we're talking about centuries ago, so it's not...
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a heritage. And
Cockney, and again, it's just from books or maybe Oliver or something, like that they were thieves and crooks, but that's not true, right?
Well, certainly not in my case. it was basically anybody who was born within the sound of Bow Bells. Bow is an area of northeast London.
Okay.
So if you were within born within the sound of the church bells, you're considered to be a Cockney. But essentially, you're a Londoner from a part of London.
But it's not a derogatory thing.
Oh, no.
Just an area. Okay.
It's just an area. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why. It must have been from some movie that I thought it was like a thing. Mm. But okay, good. All right. Now that that's clear. Okay. So you were born there. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah. One brother. Deceased, sadly. But yes, one brother.
Sorry. Okay. And when did you start playing squash? Or when did you learn about it?
Basically, I played a few times at Wembley Squash Centre, which had just been opened in northeast London, which actually became a venue I used for events when my soccer was cancelled. So no football. We played a few games of squash, and then I got into squash myself, which was an interesting story because I just got a job working for Rolex Watches as an office gopher. It was my first job. We sponsored what was called the British Amateur Closed. There was amateur status in those days. We had nothing to do with it, but my boss would turn up for the finals because we employed somebody to look after it for us. And there was a job for running events and membership and affiliation for the national body, which was called the SRA, in the magazine we took a subscription to. I thought this would be a good idea to do something for a year or two before getting a proper job. And the SRA in those days had a policy of employing people totally unsuited to the role, and I strolled it. So,
unsuited?
Yeah. So for 18 years, I was running all the events and British Open, closed, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how I came into squash.
And was that all squash, or was that other events too?
Oh, I mean, all the English events I would run, and we had, I did the squads, national squads, and oversaw membership and that sort of thing. So basically, it was all operations of the national body.
But was it all squash, or it was?
Oh, totally squash. Yes,
totally squash. Wow.
Yeah, it's
So before then, you had just played a couple of times. You weren't really a squashy.
I think it was six times I'd played.
Wow.
And, I mean, that's why I'm still improving. I've started slowly and working up.
So it really wasn't anything that you were a squash player or anything. You just got this job, and that's how you got involved.
London is built on London clay. So the mud gets... very waterlogged in the winter. So the football gets cancelled, the soccer gets cancelled, and you find something else to do. And that's
okay. Because you could do it indoors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
But obviously, after starting, I became a regular squash player. I mean, I'm still an undiscovered talent, but I'm a regular player. I haven't actually played
since. And when do you think you will get discovered?
Oh, my peak will come at the LA Olympics, where I'll be in the men's squash draw.
Are they having squash in LA?
Oh yeah, yep. It's the first time after all these years.
Wow!
I should be there spectating if I don't get into the team.
Oh, I mean you're not going to be part of the organization of the event.
In my past life, I was part of the bid team, but now I'm retired now, and I should be there on my Zimmer frame.
Just I thought, but it was close. From based on the book, it was close a couple. The 1908 Olympics, right? Almost.
No. I mean, we've been on the short list for all the previous several bid sessions, but frankly, the IOC didn't want squash, and they didn't feel it added anything to the games. Even though, we love it, they viewed it as an uncool traditional sport. So we didn't get in. Well, now we have now. Obviously, the challenge is to try and stay in for Brisbane 2032, which has already been worked upon.
Yeah, how do you think squash finally got in? Was there a big proponent?
Look, to be honest, it was leveraged through fantastic support from various people within the US community and US squash, who, along with the efforts of the World Federation and the men's the Pro Tour PSA, it was a unified effort, and it has worked. But as I say, the challenge is to stay in.
I mean, how did something like, I don't even know the name of it, when they were doing the crazy
breakdancing, you're probably thinking.
Yeah. Like, how does something like that get in and squash doesn't? You know,
well,
like,
this is all politics. It's not sport. It's the way that the IOC, which is essentially a club, decide they want to go forward, and they wanted to trial breakdance for reasons we don't need to go into, and it had its moment in the sun in 2024. It's already out for 2028.
Oh, good. There was another crazy one too. I forget.
There's always, I mean, for 2028 in Los Angeles, there's flag football, lacrosse, there's sport climbing again, and so forth. Now, how many of them will stay is up to the IOC. But they are.
So lacrosse was never in?
No.
Oh, that's a big one. At least here it is.
When I say never, decades ago it may have been, but not in recent times.
Wow.
Well, the one that will interest you is baseball and softball, because baseball and softball were separate, but the IOC decided to take them out after London in 2012.
Oh.
Partly, it seems, because there was issue about baseball clearing the dates as needed so the players could compete. Then baseball and softball federations got together, because baseball is men, softball is women, and there's very much a push towards equality. They weren't selected for Tokyo 2020, but Tokyo were desperate to get baseball in because it's a huge sport in Japan. And so the IOC, if you like, fudged it and said, we'll allow you to select a sport as long as we can have what we want. So they got baseball, softball, and karate, and the IOC got roller sports, climbing, windsurfing, and so forth. And that's the way it all operates.
Hey, I guess they could do whatever they want. It's their...
That's curious about politics, but the important thing is that squash is going to be there in 2028, which is a wonderful showcase for the sport. Because so far, our showcases have been regional, like Pan Am Games, the Asian Games, Commonwealth Games, and various other championships. So the opportunity for the players is immense to take part in the Olympics, is what everybody wants to do. And that's why I'm training so hard.
Well, I hope you make it. All right.
Well,
now, I wasn't going to talk about this yet, but I think I have to you know how when you get a picture, and who do you look for? You look for yourself, right? So when I was reading the book, I was looking for my coach. I was looking for the people I knew, blah, 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 blah. Now, what I realized early on was, for some reason, we stuck with the hardball. This is more the soft, whatever you call it, the softballs. We didn't switch to, I think, till after I graduated. Like, we played with the hardball. My coach would take us to Toronto over the Christmas break. We would have to play with the softball, which we had no training in at all. We would get wiped. But it got us in shape, because there was a lot more running with the softball, right? It stays in play longer. So I think she did it to get us in shape, you know, never mind demoralize us, which was like, I mean, I remember, this is a crazy story. I came off the court. I don't think I got one point. It was embarrassing. And she's like, would you like a cookie? What's her answer? Would you like a cookie? We laughed about that forever. Would you like a cookie? Like, how about, you know, poor thing, or you tried or something? You know? So anyway, so is that why we are not really in your book at all? Is because we just had a different whole thing with the hardball?
Well, obviously I did include hardball, but hardball was very much a localized variation of the sport until the mid-80s, where the transition to softball really took hold, which is now, as you know, the USA are a force in softball. But the book is intended to be a comprehensive history, not results of every event, but a comprehensive history. And there's a certain amount of space for everything. And hardball gets mentioned in many ways. So, for example, when Hashim Khan played the first U.S. Open in 1954, hardball, he came across, he hadn't played hardball before, but did it.
Right.
When women played, Sharif as well, yeah.
Sharif, I think I remember his name probably because he did play hardball, right?
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what we would hear it. But our guys, like I knew, you know, some of the guys that went to school with me were national champions and stuff like that. But they would they have ever competed with the softball, or that wasn't their game, so they didn't?
In the 70s and 80s, players would come over to Europe and play the British Open and so forth. But they had limited exposure of softball. Now it has completely changed. So hopefully the book, which talks about Hashim coming across to play, Sharif is mentioned because he was a British Junior Open winner before he became a hardball player and had huge success there. And you had Mark Talbot and Brad Desaunier and other players who came over, but it was the mid 80s when the courts were adapted much more so, and US squash became much more into softball, which it is completely now. When I say completely, it's completely immersed in softball. It doesn't mean
so they had to redo the courts. I don't know.
Different size courts because the hardball courts are longer. The bigger courts.
Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
But you've also got they're narrower as well. So they're 19 foot as opposed to 21 foot for a softball court. So you used to be playing on narrow courts,
right?
In the States, even when you're playing softball.
So I wonder, what I mean, I recommend this book if you have an interest in squash. It really is fascinating where it started and the rackets and but when they first started, it seemed like there was no there wasn't uniformity of the courts, right? They had open backs and they had this and that, and then. But so this is what I got, and I know we were going to talk about the book later, but we're talking about it now. So, it seemed like it started in England.
Yep.
And then when those people went traveling around the world, or when those young people grew up, this is what I'm hoping I read. I was a good student of the book, and they went to different countries. They wanted to play, so they built courts wherever they were, right?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, it was a the first courts were Harrow School, 1865, when the youngsters waiting to play other sports were hitting against a wall, and it came to St Paul's in Conover, New Hampshire, in the 1880s. People coming to universities in England, which had courts, the empire expanding. So, in both respects, as you say, people wanted to play wherever they were. And courts were built, and I would mention, because I wasn't the sole author of the book, as you'll see on the cover, Baz Van Horn, and Baz is a fantastic collector of old memorabilia, rackets, and so forth, and so much of it has come from him that has really brought the book to life, as you can see from the old rackets photo. And so forth. So, from those beginnings, it has become a worldwide sport. But courts were only standardized when the SRA, the England squash, started in 1928. There had been a little bit just before, but essentially 1928, there wasn't a world federation till 1967. So it was being played, and events were happening. The British Open started for women in 1922 and men in 1930, and so on. But as a structured sport, it took a while from 1865 to get to where we are now, with a worldwide sport, with world federation, regional federations, national federations, and state stroke county organizations.
All right, I have two questions. One is, if St. Paul's started very early in the 1880s in New Hampshire, how did we go off to the hardball? Do you know what I mean? Like, how did that divide happen? Or were they just doing what they were doing?
To be honest, I would need to revise myself, because I've actually forgotten. But there's a superb history of squash, written rather than an illustrated history, by James Zug, who is American, and of course has covered primarily the American angle, which is a fantastic resource for anybody wanting to know about how the development of hardball and the transition into softball.
Okay.
Our book has really just covered the general rather than the absolute detail.
But and I know
St. Paul's was the first court there that we know of.
Who was?
St. Paul's, Conover, was the first.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, all right. So if in 1928 it got standardized with the beginning of the SRA, then did people have to rebuild all their courts, or did that just happen over time?
People were playing on non-standard courts, and indeed around the world they still are in many ways.
But they were, or they weren't?
No, they were and still are playing on non-standard courts.
Oh, non-standard, okay.
But for competition, but mostly now people know it's 21 foot by 32 feet. But depending upon circumstances, you know, when squash started there, places like the Philadelphia Racquet Club and the others that embraced it early on, if they didn't have the space for a 21 foot wide court, they would adjust slightly. And there's still one in London where it's 20 foot wide as opposed to 21 foot, because that was the space they had in the building.
Okay.
But you wouldn't play
only like a
major events on it. You know,
yeah. It's right.
A social squash, who cares? As long as it's roughly the right shape and you can have a good game. But there are standard.
When I know there was some reference to the 10. And I don't remember, let me see. I have my notes here. You know, at the beginning, it didn't seem like they played off the back wall because they were open, right? You know, when they were playing in the...
Very initially, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But then they must have added the back wall, right? And then when... I'm looking...
Well, the tin was always there.
Racquetball. Racquetball. At 1976, there's no tin. So the racquetball, any part of the front would be okay versus... With us, if it goes, boom, it's out.
Yeah, well, racquetball, you can use the ceiling and all sorts, can't you? It's a different game. But squash, the tin was standardized at 19 inches, 48 centimeters. It still is for general play. For competition play, it's 2 inches lower, 17 inches, 43 for tournaments. Yeah, and for that doubles events, we talk about international doubles, it's 13 inches, as opposed to 19. But for general play, you know, when you go down to a club, it's 19 inches.
Why would they make it bigger for tournament play?
Well, the tin, it was for thought, and we're going back to the 1980s, that the players were too good, they could get everything back. So if you lower the tin slightly, it took the players forward a little bit more and made it more attractive to go for winners. That was the plan. Okay. And the women went across to it in 2009, the lower tin.
Oh, interesting. I don't know how you would play doubles without killing each other. It must be a bigger court.
Well, social doubles is played on a normal standard squash court. But for competition like the World Doubles or in the Commonwealth Games or the Pan Am Games, the court goes from 21 feet right out to 25 feet. So it's a wider court.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I can't even imagine how you play it.
The difference with squash, I think, with and racquetball is squash, if you play doubles, you tend to play side and side. So, okay. whereas racquetball and indeed squash 57, which is also called racquetball in here, but it's a different game. It's front and back.
Oh,
yeah. You go to the back and go forward. So it's a different movement. But
wow. Because
low light here on a wider court for competition doubles, but friendly doubles, which is what I play as well, but. I think one of the differences you'll notice is in the States, there's much more doubles than there are in other places around the world. Squash is primarily a singles game elsewhere. But because of the hardball background, there's much more doubles your side of the pond.
Because they're not as in shape?
I didn't say that.
Could that be why? Because the hardball, you could put away more winners, right? In the softball, it bounces. You can get it. You know, there's a lot more chance of getting it, right?
Yeah, players of all ages and all abilities playing all the games. So I wouldn't generalize like that.
Okay.
Except when
you scratch that on the record, Your Honor. Please scratch that on the record. All right.
Case for the defense.
Yes. All right. We're going to go to our commercial break, and then we're going to come right back. All right. Mm-hmm. And hear the rest of the story. See you in a minute.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. It's a experiential social-emotional learning platform that you can bring to your schools and help your children become more socially oriented, especially after COVID when they were isolated and by themselves. It really is something that can bring kids together, feeling a part of a community, and it's really quite wonderful. So you can find them at Kikoriapp.com, and you can schedule a consultation with them. And then my books, I always like to shamelessly promote my books because who else is going to but me? This was my first memoir, second piece of French toast. It's a story of when I was kind of stuck in a dark squash court, let's say, and didn't know how to get out. But I found my way and I wrote the book in case there were other people who were stuck as well. This one is also, I learned that on that dark side, there were times when I was on the fun side and I decided to look for more tools and techniques that had me spend less time on the dark side and more on the fun side. So I put a book together because I thought maybe that would be useful for other people. It's called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. And then this book is the one that the commercial was about, Real Talk. I was someone who was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony. That's why I started getting real. And I didn't speak up. And I didn't even know I didn't speak up. And once I started to, I realized, wow, life is a lot better, a lot more free when I can do that. But it wasn't easy. So I wrote this book. It's got the Getting Real process that can help you speak up as well if you're someone like me who everything was fine. And I really thought it was. But once I started talking, I realized, oh, that is not fine. So it got me to be able to create a life that I enjoy a lot more. So those are my books. And now we're going to bring back the king of squash, Andrew Shelley. I think we need to get you a crown because now I've just named you the king of squash. So do you have any crowns lying around you could wear for the rest of the interview?
Well, due to be what's going on in our royal family here, I've moved up a couple of places. I'm sort of about 25 million in lines of succession, so I might make it. You never know.
All right, well.
Anyway, let's not get on to that.
Well, I'll be curious as to see whether you play in the Olympics first or become part of the royal family first. So what do you think might, what do you think has more of a shot?
Look out the window, there's a pig flying by.
All right, cool. All right, so where were we? So you had the job of, going way back, you had the job for 18 years and the British Amateur, the Wembley Sports Centre, right? And what happened after that?
Well, yes, 18 years I was running all the events in the British Open. Then in 1994, I decided I needed a change and resigned. And the Women's Pro Tour called Whisper approached me and said, would I run their tour? And I did that for 15 years. Then I decided that they needed some fresh blood. So I resigned then, 2010. And WSF, the World Squash Federation, approached me and asked me if I'd become their CEO, which I did till I retired. But I'm an administrator. I'm not a public front. I don't have that sort of personality. I'm not a public speaker. I'm not a persuader. I'm an administrator, and I've always preferred to be in the background, which suited me well. And the only having.
What did you do as an administrator? Is it like accounting or organization?
No. I mean, for the women's tour, my job was to develop the calendar, liaise with the events, make sure there were more of them, increase the prize money, look after the needs of the players. It's running the professional tour, and the girls were and still are, of course, a terrific bunch of finely tuned athletes who really work at their game, and they deserve as much in the way of rewards and prize money and everything else that you can get for them, and to look after their interests, because although the players, male or female, are essentially a product that of the entertainment industry, people have to want to watch them and so forth. They're applying their trade and need to be looked after to make sure they're not taken advantage of, that their conditions are good, from courts to arrangements,
to
rules, regulations.
So was there a set group of professionals? Like, did they kind of belong? You worked for the World Squash Federation, right?
No, that was from 2010. From 1994 to 2010, I was running the women's squash tour, which was completely independent.
Completely what? I'm sorry.
Completely independent, eventually growing to getting $1 million prize money in the early noughties and then onward.
So that was your job, was to get the prize money?
Yeah. Well, my job was to do everything, basically, because there were only two of us, Heather Hills, who I worked with, and myself, who were running the tour. So it was everything for everybody.
And how did you get prize money like that?
Well, the difficult part was getting the prize money on the promoters interested in putting on an event. Once they did the first year, when the girls came, they carried on because the girls were such fantastic ambassadors for the sport. But it was the first year. And that, funnily enough, is how I met Tom Tarantino, because he ran the Philadelphia Open, and I would contact him every year and say, look, Tom, are you happy to register your women's event? And here are the details and how can we help, etc.
So that would be part of the pro tour.
Part of the pro tour, and men's and women's, but I was only doing the women's. So whilst I didn't actually know him except to deal with his registration once a year, he contacted me saying he wanted to go to the Al-Ahram event in Egypt, which was played outside the pyramids, which as a holiday with a friend. And I said, well, it's funny you should say that because I help run it, so I can help you with the arrangements. So he came out and I arranged his hotel and transport. He obviously paid for himself, but I was able to arrange it. And we got talking and he decided he wanted to do something different for squash, which involved himself and in a different way. And we alighted on the idea of taking two top women players to young squash countries once a year. The girls would give their time free. Tom would sponsor the flights. The host would pay for the hotel. And it would give the opportunity in that country for people to see squash, meet the media, meet the players. And we did that from 1999 right through till I finished in 2010. Then we used to say, well, the WSF, the World Federation, should be doing this. So when I joined the WSF, he said, well, do you want to carry on? I said, okay. So we took one male, one female, a coach and a referee, doing exactly the same thing, ambassadors program once a year with everybody giving their time free to help the sport. And he's carried on in a wonderful way by supporting the library, because obviously it's not an income earner, but I have to pay for renting a room for the physical library and all the other costs that go with it. So yes, he's made a huge difference to the sport, men, women, the library, from his Philadelphia base.
Now, it seems like, I happened to go to school in Philadelphia. That's where I learned squash and all that. It seemed like Philadelphia is tell me if I'm wrong, the hub of squash in the U.S.
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, when the ash cloud hit in 2010, I was running a women's event in Cayman Islands. And all of us, the players, had to take our first flight back to the various places we were all going to in the States to then get across to Europe. So Tom said, well, if you're staying here, why don't you stay with me? Because I was stuck there. It turned out for 5 days before the cloud cleared and planes started taking off. Wow. And he took me to some of the clubs there. And, of course, the country clubs and the rackets club. But since then, having been back, there's Drexel, there's now the Spectre Center. There's 30-something courts within one little block virtually. And I know the US Junior Open was there last month, and it can be played in multiple facilities all very close, which it is the hub of squash in terms of numbers of courts in a small area. But all the universities have large numbers of courts.
I went to something, I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago where they had redone the courts at Penn and actually named part of it for my coach. And I guess other people who donated money got their own courts too. I think
that's a huge feature of American generosity that you don't see to the same extent elsewhere. When US squash bid for and got the World Junior Men's in 1998 for Princeton, I was helping the WSF then, even though I wasn't done. Mm. So I did the venue inspection. So off I go to Princeton to check the courts, the hotel and everything else. And a lady showed me around and she said, and I remember the name of the fencing was called the Zanfrelli room or something. Mm-hmm. And there was Forbes Hall and a Jadwin gym. And eventually she said, and here's the conference room. And I said, well, what year was conference there? And off she went to find out, because every room was named after somebody in the place, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm not knocking it for a second. I think it's fantastic, the generosity. But the facilities were second to none there. And, of course, I've been to other universities since then and seen. And the World Juniors were at Harvard in 2000. The girls, this was in 2011. Yeah, super. So it's, although the USA doesn't seem to have the breadth of clubs for the working class person to play after work, at the Ivy League end and at the urban program end, and hopefully moving up towards the middle, squash is growing dramatically. It's a tribute to the efforts there.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I played tennis. And then when I got to Penn, they were like, well, you're not going to, was not going to make the team. So they said, why don't you go play squash? It was right in the next building. And I didn't even know what squash was. So then I learned, and by sophomore year, I was on the varsity, which was kind of cool. And by senior year, I was captain, which was nice. At the time, they didn't recruit the good players. They started right when I left. I might have told you that in our other conference. So it was a great opportunity for me. And my coach, you know, was like having a free lesson every day from Ann Wetzel. But it wasn't known. And I mean, I think maybe racquetball, I don't even know if they're playing that now. They're playing pickleball. I don't know. Do you have that over there?
In a small paddle as I think you call it over there, is the growing sport here. Pickleball, not so much. But there is pickleball here, yeah.
But we don't, like squash isn't, you know, if you didn't go to a prep school like St. Paul's or something, you know, people played there. If you weren't part of the main line or whatever in Ballackinwood and all the Kinwoods, you know, I mean, they obviously knew what it was growing up. But where I was, I never even heard of it. But it sounds like it's different over in England, but that it's something that people play. Yeah. You know, maybe there's not as much tennis courts because of the, I don't know. Why do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, you go to England or indeed Australia, New Zealand, and you talk to anybody and they know squash because either they have played in the past or know about it. The States is different. I was over in Dallas. There's a place called Plaza of the Americas. I don't know if you know it, which has got an atrium with an ice rink at the bottom. And we had the Texas Open women's event there in 2001, 2003, that period. And the organizers had put huge banners all around the place saying Texas Open squash. And people would come out of the offices, look over the balcony, and I would stand there just listening. And they say, so is that badminton? And yet it says Texas Open squash because people weren't exposed. And that's the challenge that I think still exists to a great extent.
Interesting.
You don't have necessarily the media penetration that you need. So it's finding people who can transcend the squash to become known sports men and women nationally. And that's hard.
Yeah. Well, it's like soccer, like, you know, soccer, you call it football over there, but, you know, here they play real football and that's the big thing. Soccer's it's what little kids do outside, you know, and some go on, but it's not as big. And I think, you know, like in the summers is when we would play sports when we're out of school. Tennis was outside. Like, who wants to go indoors, you know, but it could have been good in the winter, but it wasn't offered at schools, you know.
But the difference there is that for soccer, a huge amount of money's been thrown at it. And therefore, it has taken on a life of its own. And you've got the World Cup coming. Squash never has the money to market itself to the level that something like soccer can do, if necessary. And you know, USA women have been world champions in soccer. I'm talking about and there's a number of male players playing around the world. It's taken off. There's all the various franchises, the MSL and so forth. But we haven't got that. We've got a traditional sport with little money to spend on marketing, and so everybody's efforts help, but it hasn't got that big umbrella.
Right.
But the Olympics will certainly help, because it's actually bringing in more funds to national federations to help train players, more grants as it were. The WSF are not going to get any more money, or PSA at this point, because it has to be in for two games. But if it can stay in, then there'll be more seed money to help develop the sport. But of course, what will happen in the next 3 years is the profile of the sport will raise while players are showcased, more events. I mean, you have the Tournament of Champions in this month at the Grand Central Terminal in New York.
Yeah.
With a couple of 100,000 people a week or whatever the number is walking past the court. Because of the Olympics, there'll probably be more local media features about it as well. That can be. So everything can
help. How that got started. Like, how did that get started in Grand Central? You know,
From memory, it's John Nimick who organized. I think the first year it was there was 1995. I could be wrong. It's in the book, actually. before that, the event was played in other places, and it's in he's I don't remember the actual detail, but he found that the waiting room there, basically on one side of the entrance of 42nd Street, and put the court in there. I mean, it's one of the smallest venues on the tour in terms of numbers of people who can watch sitting. Walking past is a matter. There's, you know, tens of thousands of commuters.
They built the Penn Club in New York. Mm-hmm. It's right near Grand Central. It's not that old, but they didn't put squash courts in it, which I was like, so anyway, but so you have to go use the Yale Club or Harvard Club or something like that. But what they have are, there's a alumni event coming up, which is the same time as the Grand Central tournament. So last time we walked over and got into the stands for the squash. Mm-hmm. So that's in a few weeks. I'm going to try to get there again. But anyway, it's, you know, I was like, what? Squash club and a squash court in Grand Central? Mm-hmm. Like, who thinks of that? But I guess it's evolving. But anyway, this has been so interesting, and we have like a minute and a half left, believe it or not. What would you like to leave people with? Like, what is your vision, I don't know, for squash, for the book, for the library? Go ahead.
My vision is that more and more people understand where we've come from, who the great past champions are from. You know, we mentioned Hashim Khan and Jonah Barrington and Jeff Hunt and Jahangir Khan. And indeed, from the state's point of view, the first winner of the U.S. Open, Henry Salaam, these sort of people, we need to know what their background was, and the book has showcased them. The library through resources. All I'm trying to do is to encourage interest in history. So if anybody is interested, it's squashlibrary.info is the website, and that's where you can find the resources, the information, and indeed buy the book. But it's the future is great because of the LA Olympics and hope, and the countries that are expanding, others are struggling, but hopefully they can turn that around. But we still can't forget where we've come from, and that's what the library does.
Wow. Well, thank you for your dedication, for your passion, and for bringing this beautiful book to the world. And it's available again at squashlibrary.info. That's where they can get.
That's right. And please come and watch me in the LA Olympics.
I will definitely, if you're there, I will get to LA to watch.
I'll be in the European Ryder Cup team first, but after that, it's the Olympics for me. Yeah.
All right, good. Can't wait.
Pleasure.
And then we'll see you with your crown next. So,
spirit. You can assume me.
What'd you say?
It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.